widely about crime and punishment. One paper he wrote as a graduate student is still regularly cited. His question was disarmingly simple. Do more police translate into less crime? The answer would seem obvious, yes, but had never been proved. Since the number of police officers tends to rise along with the number of crimes, the effectiveness of the police was tricky to measure. Levitt needed a mechanism that would unlink the crime rate from police hiring. He found it within politics. He noticed that mayors and governors running for re-election often hire more police officers. By measuring those police increases against crime rates, he was able to determine that additional officers do indeed bring down violent crime. That paper was later disputed. Another graduate student found a serious mathematical mistake in it. But Levitt's ingenuity was obvious. He began to be acknowledged as a master of the simple, clever solution. He was the guy who, in the slapstick scene, sees all the engineers futzing with a broken machine and then realizes that no one has thought to plug it in. Arguing that police helped deter crime didn't make Levitt any enemies. Arguing that abortion deterred crime was another matter. In the abortion paper, published in 2001, he and Donahue warned that their findings should not be seen, quote, as either an endorsement of abortion or a call for intervention by the state in the fertility decisions of women. They suggested that crime might just as easily be curbed by, in their words, providing better environments for those children at greatest risk for future crime. Still, the very topic managed to offend nearly everyone. Conservatives were enraged that abortion could be construed as a crime-fighting tool. Liberals were aghast that poor and black women were singled out. Economists grumbled that Levitt's methodology was not sound. A syllogism, after all, can be a magic trick. All cats die. Socrates died. Therefore, Socrates was a cat. I think he's enormously clever in so many areas, focusing very much on the issue of reverse causality, says Ted Joyce, an economist at Baruch College who has written a critical response to the abortion paper. But in this case, I think he ignored it or didn't tend to it well enough. As the news media gorged on the abortion crime story, Levitt came under direct assault. He was called an ideologue by conservatives and liberals alike, a eugenicist, a racist, and downright evil. In reality, he seems to be very much none of these. He has little taste for politics and less for moralizing. He's genial, low-key and unflappable, confident but not cocky. He is a respected teacher and colleague. He is a sought-after collaborator who, because of the breadth of his curiosities, often works with scholars outside his field, another rarity for an economist. I hesitate to use these words, but Steve is a con man in the best sense, says Sudhir Venkatesh, a sociologist at Columbia University. He's the Shakespearean jester. He'll make you believe his ideas were yours. Venkatesh was Levitt's co-author on An Economic Analysis of a Drug-Selling Gang's Finances, which found that the average street dealer lives with his mother because the take-home pay is, frankly, terrible. The paper analyzed one crack gang's financial activities as if it were any corporation. It was Venkatesh who procured the data from a former gang member. Such a thing had never been tried. This lack of focus, Levitt deadpanned in one version of the paper, is perhaps partly attributable to the fact that few economists have been involved in the study of gangs. Levitt speaks with a boyish lisp. His appearance is high nerd, a plain button-down shirt, nondescript khakis, and a braided belt, sensible shoes. His pocket calendar is branded with the National Bureau of Economic Research logo. I wish he would get more than 3 haircuts a year, his wife Jeanette says, and that he wasn't still wearing the same glasses he got 15 years ago, which weren't even in fashion then. He was a good golfer in high school, but has so physically atrophied that he calls himself the weakest human being alive, and he asks Jeanette to open jars around the house. There is nothing in his appearance or manner, in other words, that suggests a flamethrower. He will tell you that all he does is sit at his desk day and night, wrestling with some strange mountain of data. He will tell you that he would do it free. His salary is reportedly more than $200,000, and you tend to believe him. He may be an accidental provocateur, but he's a provocateur nonetheless. He takes particular delight in catching wrongdoers. In one paper, he devised a set of algorithms that could identify teachers in the Chicago public school system who were cheating. Cheating classrooms will systematically differ from other classrooms along a number of dimensions, he and his co-author, Brian Jacob of the Kennedy School of Government, wrote in Catching Cheating Teachers. For instance, students in cheating classrooms are likely to experience unusually large test score gains in the year of the cheating, followed by unusually small gains or even declines in the following year when the boost attributable to cheating disappears. Levitt used test score data from the Chicago schools that had long been available to other researchers. There were a number of ways he realized that a teacher could cheat. If she were particularly brazen and stupid, she might just give students the correct answers. Or, after the test, she might actually erase students' wrong answers and fill in correct ones. A sophisticated cheater would be careful to avoid conspicuous blocks of identical answers. But Levitt was more sophisticated. The first step in analyzing suspicious strings is to estimate the probability each child would give a particular answer on each question, he wrote. This estimation is done using a multinomial logit framework with past test scores, demographics, and socioeconomic characteristics as explanatory variables. So, by measuring any number of factors, the difficulty of a particular question, the frequency with which students got hard questions right and easy ones wrong, the degree to which certain answers were highly correlated in one classroom, Levitt identified which teachers he thought were cheating. Perhaps just as valuable, he was also able to identify the good teachers. The Chicago school system, rather than disputing Levitt's findings, invited him into the schools for retesting. As a result, the cheaters were fired. Then there is his forthcoming paper, Understanding Why Crime Fell in the 1990s. Four factors that explain the decline, and seven that do not. The entire drop in crime, Levitt says, was due to more police officers, more prisoners, the waning crack epidemic, and Roe v. Wade. One factor that probably didn't make a difference, he argues, was the innovative policing strategy trumpeted in New York by Rudolph Giuliani and William Bratton. I think, Levitt says, I'm pretty much alone in saying that. He comes from a Minneapolis family of high, if unusual, achievers. His father, a medical researcher, is considered a leading authority on intestinal gas. He bills himself as the man who gave status to flatus and class to gas. One of Levitt's great uncles, Robert May, wrote Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the book, that is. Another great uncle, Johnny Marks, later wrote the song. At Harvard, Levitt wrote his senior thesis on thoroughbred breeding and graduated summa cum laude. He is still obsessed with horse racing. He says he believes it is corrupt and has designed a betting system, the details of which he will not share, to take advantage of the corruption. He worked for 2 years as a management consultant before enrolling at MIT for a doctorate in economics. The MIT program was famous for its mathematical intensity. Levitt had taken exactly one math course as an undergraduate and had forgotten even that. During his first graduate class, he asked the student next to him about a formula on the board. Is there any difference between the derivative sign that's straight up and down and the curly one? You are in so much trouble, he was told. People wrote him off, recalls Austin Goolsbee, the Chicago economist who was then a classmate. They'd say, that guy has no future. Levitt set his own course. Other grad students stayed up all night working on problem sets, trying to make good grades. He stayed up researching and writing. My view is that the way you succeed in this profession is you write great papers, he says, so I just started. Sometimes he would begin with a question. Sometimes it was a set of data that caught his eye. He spent one entire summer typing into his computer the results of years' worth of congressional elections. Today, with so much information so easily available on the internet, Levitt complains that he can't get his students to input data at all. All he had was a vague curiosity about why incumbents were so often reelected. Then he happened upon a political science book whose authors claimed that money wins elections, period. They were trying to explain election outcomes as a function of campaign expenditures, he recalls, completely ignoring the fact that contributors will only give money to challengers when they have a realistic chance of winning, and incumbents only spend a lot when they have a chance of losing. They convinced themselves this was the causal story, even though it's so obvious in retrospect that it's a spurious effect. Obvious at least to Levitt, within 5 minutes, he had a vision of the paper he would write. It came to me, he says, in full bloom. The problem was that his data couldn't tell him who was a good candidate and who wasn't. It was therefore impossible to tease out the effect of the money. As with the police crime rate puzzle, he had to trick the data. Because he himself had typed in the data, he had noticed something. Often, the same two candidates faced each other multiple times. By analyzing the data from only those elections, Levitt was able to find a true result. His conclusion? Campaign money has about one-tenth the impact as was commonly accepted. An unknown graduate student at the time, he sent his paper to the Journal of Political Economy. One professor told him he was crazy for even trying, where it was published. He completed his PhD in 3 years, but because of his priorities, he says he was invisible to the faculty. A real zero, he says. Then he stumbled upon what he now calls the turning point in his career. He had an interview for the Society of Fellows, the venerable intellectual Harvard clubhouse that pays young scholars to do their own work for 3 years with no commitments. Levitt felt he didn't stand a chance. For starters, he didn't consider himself an intellectual. He would be interviewed over dinner by the senior fellows, a collection of world-renowned philosophers, scientists, and historians. He worried he wouldn't have enough conversation for even the first course. Instead, he was on fire. Whatever subject came up, the brain, ants, philosophy, he just happened to remember something pithy he'd read. His wit crackled as it had never crackled before. When he told them about the 2 summers he spent betting the horses back in Minnesota, they ate it up. Finally, disquietingly, one of them said, "I'm having a hard time seeing the unifying theme of your work. Could you explain it?" Levitt was stymied. He had no idea what his unifying theme was, or even if he had one. Amartya Sen, the future Nobel-winning economist, jumped in and neatly summarized what he saw as Levitt's theme. "Yes," Levitt said eagerly, "that's my theme." Another fellow then offered another theme. "You're right," Levitt said, "that's my theme." And so it went, like dogs tugging at a bone, until the philosopher Robert Nozick interrupted. If Levitt could have been said to have an intellectual hero, it would be Nozick. "How old are you, Steve?" Nozick asked. 26. Nozick turned to the other fellows. "He's 26 years old. Why does he need to have a unifying theme? Maybe he's going to be one of those people who's so talented he doesn't need one. He'll take a question, he'll just answer it, and it'll be fine." The University of Chicago's economics department had a famous unifying theme, the gospel of free markets with a conservative twist, and would therefore not have seemed the most likely fit for Levitt. As he sees it, Chicago is about theory, deep thinking, and big ideas, while he is about empiricism, clever thinking, and cute but ultimately insubstantial ideas. But Chicago also had Gary Becker. To Levitt, Becker is the most influential economist of the past 50 years. Long before it was fashionable, Becker brought microeconomic theory to offbeat topics, the family and crime in particular. For years, Becker was demonized. A single phrase like "the price of children" would set off untold alarms. "I took a lot of heat over my career from people who thought my work was silly or irrelevant or not economics," Becker says today. But Chicago supported him. He persevered, winning the Nobel Prize in 1992, and he became Stephen Levitt's role model. Becker told Levitt that Chicago would be a great environment for him. "Not everybody agrees with all your results," he said, "but we agree what you're doing is very interesting work and will support you in that." Levitt soon found that the support at Chicago went beyond the scholarly. The year after he was hired, his wife gave birth to their first child, Andrew. One day, just after Andrew turned a year old, he came down with a slight fever. The doctor diagnosed an ear infection. When he started vomiting the next morning, his parents took him to the hospital. A few days later, he was dead of pneumococcal meningitis. Amid the shock and grief, Levitt had an undergraduate class that needed teaching. It was Gary Becker, a Nobel laureate nearing his 70th birthday, who sat in for Levitt. Another colleague, D. Gail Johnson, sent a condolence card that Levitt still quotes from memory. Levitt and Johnson, an agricultural economist in his 80s, began speaking regularly. Levitt learned that Johnson's daughter was one of the first Americans to adopt a daughter from China. Soon the Levitts adopted a daughter of their own, whom they named Amanda. In addition to Amanda, they have since had a daughter, now almost three, and a son. But Andrew's death has played on in various ways. They have become close friends with the family of the little girl to whom they donated Andrew's liver. They also donated his heart, but that baby died. And, not surprisingly for a scholar who pursues real-life subjects, the death also informed Levitt's work. He and Jeanette joined a support group for grieving parents. Levitt was struck by how many children had drowned in swimming pools. They were the kinds of deaths that don't make the newspaper, unlike, for instance, a child who dies while playing with a gun. Levitt was curious and went looking for numbers that would tell the story. He wrote up the results as an op-ed article for the Chicago Sun-Times. It featured the sort of plangent counterintuition for which he has become famous. If you own a gun and have a swimming pool in the yard, the swimming pool is almost 100 times more likely to kill a child than the gun is. Trying to get his mind off death, Levitt took up a hobby, rehabbing and selling old houses in Oak Park, where he lives. This experience has led to yet another paper about the real estate market. It is his most Chicago-style paper yet, a romp in price theory, a sign that the university's influence on him is perhaps as strong as his influence on it. But Levitt being Levitt, it also deals with corruption. While negotiating to buy old houses, he found that the seller's agent often encouraged him, albeit cagily, to underbid. This seemed odd. Didn't the agent represent the seller's best interest? Then he thought more about the agent's role. Like many other experts, auto mechanics and stockbrokers come to mind, a real estate agent is thought to know his field far better than a layperson. A homeowner is encouraged to trust the agent's information. So, if the agent brings in a low offer and says it might just be the best the homeowner can expect, the homeowner tends to believe him. But the key, Levitt determined, lay in the fact that agents, as he wrote, receive only a small share of the incremental profit when a house sells for a higher value. Like a stockbroker churning commissions or a bookie grabbing his vig, an agent was simply looking to make a deal, any deal, so he would push homeowners to sell too fast and too cheap. Now, if Levitt could only measure this effect. Once again, he found a clever mechanism. Using data from more than 50,000 home sales in Cook County, Illinois, he compared the figures for homes owned by real estate agents with those for homes for which they acted only as agents. The agents' homes stayed on the market about 10 days longer and sold for 2% more. Late on a summer afternoon, Levitt is in his office, deep inside one of the university's Gothic behemoths. The ceiling is stained, the plaster around the window crumbling. He is just back from a sabbatical at Stanford, and his desk is a holy mess, stacks of books and journals, a green sippy cup, and a little orange squeeze hippo. This is his afternoon to meet with students. Levitt drinks a Mountain Dew and talks softly. Some students come for research assignments, some for advice. One has just written her undergraduate thesis, The Labor Market Consequence of Graduating College in a Bad Economy. For a thesis, Levitt tells her, it's very good, but now she wants to have it published. You write like a college student, and that's a problem, he says. The thing is, you're telling a story. There's foreshadowing going on, all those tricks. You want the reader going down a particular path, so when they get the results, they understand them and believe them. But you also want to be honest about your weaknesses. people are much less harsh on weaknesses that are clear than weaknesses that are hidden, as they should be. Be honest about your weaknesses. Has there ever been a prize-winning scholar as honest about his weaknesses as Stephen Levitt? He doesn't understand economics, he claims, or math. He's a little thinker in a world of big thinkers. Can't even open a jar of spaghetti sauce at home, the poor guy. Friends say that Levitt's self-deprecation is as calculated as it is genuine. Within academia, economists take pride in being the most cutthroat of a cutthroat breed. Anyone who writes papers on the weakest link, contestants discriminate against Latino and elderly peers, Levitt concluded, but not blacks or women, and sumo wrestling, to best manage their tournament rankings, wrestlers often conspire to throw matches, had better not also be arrogant. Or maybe it is not self-deprecation at all. Maybe it is self-flagellation. Maybe what Stephen Levitt really wants is to graduate from his silly and trivial and shallow topics. He thinks he's on to something with a new paper about black names. He wants to know if someone with a distinctly black name suffers an economic penalty. His answer, contrary to other recent research, is no. But now he has a bigger question. Is black culture a cause of racial inequality, or is it a consequence? For an economist, even for Levitt, this is new turf, quantifying culture, he calls it. As a task, he finds it thorny, messy, perhaps impossible, and deeply tantalizing. Driving home to Oak Park that evening, his Cavalier glumly thrumming along the Eisenhower Expressway, Levitt dutifully addresses his future. Leaving academia for a hedge fund or a government job does not interest him, though he might, on the side, start a company to catch cheating teachers. He is said to be at the top of every economics department's poaching list, but the tree that he and Jeanette planted when Andrew died is getting too big to move. You get the feeling he may stay at Chicago a while. There are important problems, he says, that he feels ready to address. For instance, tax evasion, he says, money laundering. I'd like to put together a set of tools that lets us catch terrorists. I mean, that's the goal. I don't necessarily know yet how I'd go about it, but given the right data, I have little doubt that I could figure out the answer. It might seem absurd for an economist to dream of catching terrorists, just as it must have seemed absurd if you were a Chicago school teacher, called into an office and told that, the algorithms designed by that skinny man with thick glasses had determined that you are a cheater and that you are being fired. Stephen Levitt may not fully believe in himself, but he does believe in this. Teachers and criminals and real estate agents may lie, and politicians and even CIA analysts, but numbers don't. Up in Smoke, Whatever Happened to Crack Cocaine? From the New York Times Magazine, August 7th, 2005. If you rely on the news media for your information, you probably think that crack cocaine is a thing of the past. If you rely on data, however, you reach a different conclusion. Measuring the use and impact of a drug like crack isn't easy. There's no government website to provide crack data, and surveying dealers is bound to be pretty unreliable. So how can you get to the truth of crack use? One way is to look at a variety of imperfect but plausible proxies, including cocaine arrests, emergency room visits, and deaths. Unlike the volume of news coverage, the rates for all these remain shockingly high. Cocaine arrests, for instance, have fallen only about 15% since the crack boom of the late 1980s. Cocaine-related deaths are actually higher now. So are the number of emergency room visits due to cocaine. When combined in a sensible way, these proxies can be used to construct a helpful index of crack cocaine. And what does this index reveal? It says that crack use was non-existent until the early 1980s and spiked like mad in 1985, peaking in 1989. It says that it arrived early on the West Coast, but became most prevalent in the cities of the Northeast and Middle Atlantic states, and that it produced a remarkable level of gun violence, particularly among young black men who made up the bulk of street-level crack dealers. During the crack boom, the homicide rate among 13 to 17-year-old blacks more than quadrupled. But perhaps the biggest surprise in the crack index is the fact that as of 2000, the most recent year for which the index data are available, Americans were still smoking about 70% as much crack as they smoked when consumption was at its peak. If so much crack is still being sold and bought, why aren't we hearing about it? Well, because crack-associated violence has largely disappeared, and it was the violence that made crack most relevant to the middle class. What made the violence go away? Simple economics. Urban street gangs were the main distributors of crack cocaine. In the beginning, demand for their product was phenomenal, and so were the potential profits. Most crack killings, it turns out, were not a result of some crackhead sticking up a grandmother for drug money, but rather one crack dealer shooting another, and perhaps a few bystanders, in order to gain turf. But the market changed fast. The destructive effects of the drug became apparent. Young people saw the damage that crack inflicted on older users and began to stay away from it. One recent survey showed that crack use is now 3 times as common among people in their late 30s as it is among those in their late teens and early 20s. As demand fell, price wars broke out, driving down profits. And as the amount of money at stake grew smaller, the violence also dissipated. Young gang members are still selling crack on street corners, but when a corner becomes less valuable, there is less incentive to kill or be killed for it. So how can it be that crack consumption is still so high? Part of the answer may have to do with geography. The index shows that consumption is actually up in states far from the coasts, like Arizona, Minnesota, Colorado, and Michigan. But the main answer lies in the same price shift that made the crack trade less violent. The price has fallen about 75% from its peak, which has led to an interesting consumption pattern. There are far fewer users today, but they are each smoking more crack. This too makes perfect economic sense. If you are a devoted crackhead, and the price is 1/4 what it used to be, you can afford to smoke 4 times as much. But as crack has matured into a drug that causes less social harm, the laws punishing its sale have stayed the same. In 1986, in the national frenzy that followed the death of Len Bias, a first-round NBA draft pick and a cocaine user, Congress passed legislation requiring a 5-year mandatory sentence for selling just 5 grams of crack. You would have to sell 500 grams of powder cocaine to get an equivalent sentence. This disparity has often been called racist, since it disproportionately imprisons blacks. In fact, the law probably made sense at the time, when a gram of crack cocaine did have far more devastating social costs than a gram of powder cocaine. But it doesn't anymore. Len Bias would now be 40 years old, and he would have long outlived his usefulness to the Boston Celtics. It may be time to acknowledge that the law inspired by his death has done the same. Curbing your dog. Can technology keep New York City scooped? From the New York Times Magazine, October 2, 2005. 2,500 tons. That's how much manure was produced every day by the 200,000 horses that moved people and goods around New York City in the late 19th century. Much of the manure went uncollected, which posed a terrible problem. This is to say nothing of the horse urine, the deafening clatter of hooves, or the carcasses left to rot in the street. The manure was so widespread and smelly and unsanitary that brownstones were built with their entrances on the second floor so that homeowners might rise above it. Like so many seemingly overwhelming problems, this one was resolved, quite painlessly, by technology. The electric streetcar, and then the automobile, led to the disappearance of horses, and with them went their dung. Most of the animal dung produced in today's New York comes from our dogs. Estimates of the dog population vary widely, but 1 million is a good guess. All their poop doesn't just lie there, of course. In 1978, New York enacted its famous and widely imitated pooper scooper law, and the city is plainly cleaner, poop-wise, than it was. But with a fine of just $50 for the first offense, the law doesn't provide much financial incentive to pick up after your dog. Nor does it seem to be vigorously enforced. Let's pretend that 99% of all dog owners do obey the law. That still leaves 10,000 dogs whose poop is left in public spaces each day. Over the last year, the city ticketed only 471 dog waste violations, which suggests that the typical offender stands a roughly 1 in 8,000 chance of getting a ticket. So here's the puzzle. Why do so many people pick up after their dogs? This would seem to be a case in which social incentives, the hard glare of a passerby, and the offender's feelings of guilt, are at least as powerful as financial and legal incentives. If social forces get us most of the way there, how do we deal with the occasional miscreant who fails to scoop? After all, a walk through just about any New York neighborhood confirms that compliance with the law is hardly complete. The Parks Department, meanwhile, which conducts regular cleanliness checks of parks and playgrounds, says that dog poop accounts for 20% of its cleanliness failures. Dog poop is plainly far less of a nuisance than horse manure ever was, but if you are, say, a parent who walks two kids to school every day and tries to keep all three of you from experiencing that telltale soft smush of a misstep, it is a nuisance nonetheless. With horses, the solution was simply to eliminate them. Might there be a way to get rid of dog poop without getting rid of the dogs? It might help for a moment to think of a dog as if it were a gun. Using laws to eliminate guns has proved extremely difficult. A given gun lasts a very long time, and as with dogs, guns are widely loved. But getting rid of guns should never have been the point of gun control. The point, rather, ought to be getting rid of the misuse of guns, that is, the use of guns in crimes. Consequently, the most successful policies are those that directly punish misuse, like mandatory prison sentences for any crime involving a gun. In California and elsewhere, such measures have substantially reduced gun crime. Similarly, the problem in New York is not so much with dogs per se, so perhaps attending to the real problem, their poop, will prompt a solution. Here's an idea. DNA sampling. During the licensing procedure, every dog will have to provide a sample of saliva or blood to establish a DNA file. Then, whenever a pile of poop is found on the sidewalk, a sample can be taken to establish the offender's DNA. Because stomachs and intestinal walls shed so many cells, poop is in fact a robust DNA source. During a murder trial in Indiana in 2002, the defendant was convicted in large part because the dog poop in his sneaker tread linked him to the scene of the crime. Once the fecal DNA is matched to a given dog's DNA file, the dog's owner will be mailed a ticket. It might cost about $30 million to establish a DNA sample for all the dogs of New York. If people stop violating the law, then New York has spent $30 million for cleaner streets. If not, the $30 million is seed money for a new revenue stream. Unfortunately, there's a big drawback to this plan. In order to match a pile of poop with its source, you will need to have every dog's DNA on file. And in 2003, the most recent year on record, only 102,004 dogs in New York were licensed. Even though a license is legally required, costs a mere $8.50 a year, and can be easily obtained by mail, most dog owners ignore the law, and with good reason. Last year, only 68 summonses were issued in New York City for unlicensed dogs. So even if the DNA plan were enacted today, most offenders would still go unpunished. In fact, it stands to reason that the typical licensed dog is less likely to offend than the typical unlicensed dog, since the sort of owner who is responsible enough to license his dog is also most likely responsible enough to clean up after it. How, then, to get all of New York's dogs licensed? Instead of charging even a nominal fee, the city may want to pay people to license their dogs. And then, instead of treating the licensing law as optional, enforce it for real. Setting up random street checks for dog licenses may offend some New Yorkers, but it certainly dovetails nicely with the Giuliani-era broken windows approach to low-level crime. Before you dismiss the entire dog DNA idea as idiotic, which frankly we were about to do the moment it popped into our heads, consider this. It turns out that civic leaders in Vienna and Dresden have recently floated the same idea. Indeed, one Vienna politician cited Mayor Giuliani as his inspiration. Closer to home, an eighth grade girl in Hoboken, New Jersey, has also proposed the DNA solution. During a meeting last year of the Hoboken City Council, Lauren Mecca, the daughter of a police captain, argued her dog poop case. While adults like yourselves are appalled and disgusted by the sight of the uncollected dog poop that adorns our parks and sidewalks, it is children like myself and younger who run the greater risk of contact and exposure. We are the ones who ride our bikes, throw our balls, and roll our blades on the city's sidewalks. And we're the ones who have our picnics, stage our adventures, and carry out our dragon-slaying fantasies on our park's grassy lawns. The council, Mecca says today, didn't seem to take her proposal seriously. Why? They dismissed it basically because I was a 12-year-old kid. The economy of desire. Can fear of AIDS change sexual preference? From the New York Times Magazine, December 11th, 2005. What is a price? Unless you're an economist, you probably think of a price as simply the amount you pay for a given thing. The number of dollars you surrender for, let's say, Sunday brunch at your favorite neighborhood restaurant. But to an economist, price is a much broader concept. The 20 minutes you spend waiting for a table is part of the price. So too is any nutritional downside of the meal itself. A cheeseburger, as the economist Kevin Murphy has calculated, costs $2.50 more than a salad in long-term health implications. There are moral and social costs to tally as well. For instance, the look of scorn delivered by your vegan dining partner as you order the burger. While the restaurant's menu may list the price of the cheeseburger at $7.95, that is clearly just the beginning. The most fundamental rule of economics is that a rise in price leads to less quantity demanded. This holds true for a restaurant meal, a real estate deal, a college education, or just about anything else you can think of. When the price of an item rises, you buy less of it, which is not to say, of course, that you want less of it. But what about sex? Sex, that most irrational of human pursuits, couldn't possibly respond to rational price theory, could it? Outside of a few obvious situations, we generally don't think about sex in terms of prices. Prostitution is one such situation. Courtship is another. Certain men seem to consider an expensive dinner a prudent investment in pursuit of a sexual dividend. But how might price changes affect sexual behavior? And might those changes have something to tell us about the nature of sex itself? Here is a stark example. A man who is sent to prison finds that the price of sex with a woman has spiked, talk about a supply shortage, and he becomes much more likely to start having sex with men. The reported prevalence of oral sex among affluent American teenagers would also seem to illustrate price theory. Because of the possibility of disease or pregnancy, intercourse is expensive, and it has come to be seen by some teenagers as an unwanted and costly pledge of commitment. In this light, oral sex may be viewed as a cheaper alternative. In recent decades, we have witnessed the most exorbitant new price associated with sex, the HIV virus. Because AIDS is potentially deadly, and because it can be spread relatively easily by sex between two men, the onset of AIDS in the early 1980s caused a significant increase in the price of gay sex. Andrew Francis, a graduate student in economics at the University of Chicago, has tried to affix a dollar figure to this change. Setting the value of an American life at $2 million, Francis calculated that in terms of AIDS-related mortality, it cost $1,923.75 in 1992, the peak of the AIDS crisis, for a man to have unprotected sex once with a random gay American man, versus less than $1 with a random woman. While the use of a condom greatly reduces the risk of contracting AIDS, a condom is, of course, yet another cost associated with sex. in a study of Mexican prostitution, the Berkeley economist Paul Gertler and two co-authors showed that when a client requested sex without a condom, a prostitute was typically paid a 24% premium over her standard fee. Francis, in a draft paper titled The Economics of Sexuality, tries to go well beyond dollar figures. He puts forth an empirical argument that may fundamentally challenge how people think about sex. As with any number of behaviors that social scientists try to measure, sex is a tricky subject. But Francis discovered a data set that offered some intriguing possibilities. The National Health and Social Life Survey, sponsored by the U.S. government and a handful of foundations, asked almost 3,500 people a rather astonishing variety of questions about sex, the different sexual acts received and performed and with whom and when, questions about sexual preference and identity, whether they knew anyone with AIDS. As with any self-reported data, there was the chance that the survey wasn't reliable, but it had been designed to ensure anonymity and generate honest replies. The survey was conducted in 1992, when the disease was much less treatable than it is today. Francis first looked to see if there was a positive correlation between having a friend with AIDS and expressing a preference for homosexual sex. As he expected, there was. After all, people pick their friends, Francis says, and homosexuals are more likely to have other homosexuals as friends. But you don't get to pick your family. So Francis next looked for a correlation between having a relative with AIDS and expressing a homosexual preference. This time, for men, the correlation was negative. This didn't seem to make sense. Many scientists believe that a person's sexual orientation is determined before birth, a function of genetic fate. If anything, people in the same family should be more likely to share the same orientation. Then, Francis says, I realized, oh my God, they were scared of AIDS. Francis zeroed in on this subset of about 150 survey respondents who had a relative with AIDS. Because the survey compiled these respondents' sexual histories, as well as their current answers about sex, it allowed Francis to measure, albeit crudely, how their lives may have changed as a result of having seen up close the costly horrors of AIDS. Here's what he found. Not a single man in the survey who had a relative with AIDS said he had had sex with a man in the previous 5 years. Not a single man in that group declared himself to be attracted to men or to consider himself homosexual. Women in that group also shunned sex with men. For them, rates of recent sex with women and of declaring homosexual identity and attraction were more than twice as high as those who did not have a relative with AIDS. Because the sample size was so small, simple chance suggests that no more than a handful of men in a group that size would be attracted to men. It is hard to reach definitive conclusions from the survey data. Obviously, not every single man changes his sexual behavior or identity when a relative contracts AIDS. But, taken as a whole, the numbers in Francis's study suggest that there may be a causal effect here, that having a relative with AIDS may change not just sexual behavior, but also self-reported identity and even desire. In other words, sexual preference, while perhaps largely predetermined, may also be subject to the forces more typically associated with economics than biology. If this turns out to be true, it would change the way that everyone, scientists, politicians, theologians, thinks about sexuality. But it probably won't much change the way economists think. To them, it has always been clear. Whether we like it or not, everything has its price. Filling in the tax gap. Why Americans should be clamoring for the IRS to do more audits, not fewer. From the New York Times Magazine, April 2, 2006. This is the time of year when American citizens inevitably think about the Internal Revenue Service and, also inevitably, about how deeply they hate it. But most people who hate the IRS probably do so for the wrong reasons. They think it is a tough and cruel agency, but in fact, it is not nearly as tough and cruel as it should be. The first thing to remember is that the IRS doesn't write the tax code. The agency is quick to point its finger at the true villain. In the United States, the Congress passes tax laws and requires taxpayers to comply, its mission statement says. The IRS role is to help the large majority of compliant taxpayers with the tax law, while ensuring that the minority who are unwilling to comply pay their fair share. So the IRS is like a street cop, or more precisely, the biggest fleet of street cops in the world, who are asked to enforce laws written by a few hundred people on behalf of a few hundred million people, a great many of whom find these laws too complex, too expensive, and unfair. And yet, most Americans say they are proud to pay their taxes. In an independent poll conducted last year for the IRS Oversight Board, 96% of the respondents agreed with this statement. It is every American's civic duty to pay their fair share of taxes. And 93% agreed that everyone, quote, who cheats on their taxes should be held accountable. On the other hand, when asked what influences their decision to report and pay taxes honestly, 62% answered fear of an audit, while 68% said it was the fact that their income was already being reported to the IRS by third parties. For all the civic duty floating around, it would seem that most compliance is determined by good old-fashioned incentives. So which of these incentives work and which do not? To find out, the IRS conducted the National Research Program, a 3-year study during which 46,000 randomly selected 2001 tax returns were intensively reviewed. The IRS doesn't specify what these 46,000 people were subjected to, but it may well have been the kind of inquisition that has earned the agency its horrid reputation. Using this sample, the study found a tax gap, the difference between taxes owed and taxes actually paid, of $345 billion, or nearly one-fifth of all taxes collected by the IRS. This sum happens to be just a few billion dollars less than the projected federal budget deficit for 2007. It also amounts to more than $1,000 worth of cheating by every man, woman, and child in the U.S. But most people aren't cheating. And when you take a look at who does cheat and who doesn't, it becomes pretty clear just why people pay their taxes at all. The key statistic in the IRS's study is called the net misreporting percentage. It measures the amount that was misreported on every major line item on those 46,000 returns. In the wages, salaries, and tips category, for instance, Americans are underreporting only 1% of their actual income. Meanwhile, in the non-farm proprietor income category, think of self-employed workers like a restaurateur or the boss of a small construction crew, 57% of the income goes unreported. That's $68 billion in unpaid taxes right there. Why such a huge difference between the wage earner and a restaurateur? Simple. The only person reporting the restaurateur's income to the IRS is the restaurateur himself. For the wage earner, his employer is generating a W-2 to let the IRS know exactly how much he has been paid. And the wage earner's taxes are automatically withheld from his every check, while the restaurateur has all year to decide if and how much he will pay. Does this mean that the average self-employed worker is less honest than the average wage earner? Not necessarily. It's just that he has much more incentive to cheat. He knows that the only chance the IRS has of learning his true income and expenditures is to audit him. And all he has to do is look at the IRS's infinitesimal audit rate. Last year, the agency conducted face-to-face audits on just 0.19% of all individual taxpayers, to feel pretty confident to go ahead and cheat. So why do people really pay their taxes? Because it's the right thing to do, or because they fear getting caught if they don't? It sure seems to be the latter. A combination of good technology, employer reporting and withholding, and poor logic, most people who don't cheat radically overestimate their chances of being audited, makes the system work. And while it sounds bad to hear that Americans underpay their taxes by nearly one-fifth, the tax economist Joel Slemrod estimates that the U.S. is easily within the upper tier of worldwide compliance rates. Still, unless you are personally cheating by one-fifth or more, you should be mad at the IRS. Not because it's too vigilant, but because it's not nearly vigilant enough. Why should you pay your fair share when the agency lets a few $100 billion of other people's money go uncollected every year? The IRS itself would love to change this dynamic. In the past few years, it has significantly increased its enforcement revenue and its audit rate, despite a budget that is only fractionally larger. A main task of any IRS commissioner, the current one is Mark Everson, is to beg Congress and the White House for resources. For all the obvious appeal of having the IRS collect every dollar owed to the government, it is just as obviously unappealing for most politicians to advocate a more vigorous IRS. Michael Dukakis tried this during his 1988 presidential campaign and, well, it didn't work. Left to enforce a tax code that no one likes, upon a public that knows it can practically cheat at will, the IRS does its best to fiddle around the edges. Once in a while, it hits pay dirt. In the early 1980s, an IRS research officer in Washington named John Szilagyi had seen enough random audits to know that some taxpayers were incorrectly claiming dependents for the sake of an exemption. Sometimes it was a genuine mistake, a divorced wife and husband making duplicate claims on their children, for instance. And sometimes the claims were comically fraudulent. Szilagyi recalls at least one dependent's name listed as Fluffy, who was quite obviously a pet rather than a child. Szilagyi decided that the most efficient way to clean up this mess was to simply require taxpayers to list their children's social security numbers. Initially, there was a lot of resistance to the idea, says Szilagyi, now 66 and retired to Florida. The answer I got was that it was too much like 1984. The idea never made its way out of the agency. A few years later, however, with Congress clamoring for more tax revenue, Szilagyi's idea was dug up, rushed forward, and put into law for tax year 1986. When the returns started coming in the following April, Szilagyi recalls, he and his bosses were shocked. 7 million dependents had suddenly vanished from the tax rolls, some incalculable combination of real pets and phantom children. Szilagyi's clever twist generated nearly $3 billion in revenues in a single year. Szilagyi's immediate bosses felt he should get some kind of reward for his idea, but their superiors weren't convinced. So Szilagyi called his congressman, who got the reward process back on track. Finally, 5 years after his brainstorm became the law, Szilagyi, who earned about $80,000 annually at the time, was given a check for $25,000. By this point, his idea had generated roughly $14 billion in revenue, which suggests at least one legitimate reason to dislike the IRS. If the agency hadn't been so stingy with Szilagyi's reward back then, it probably would have attracted a lot more of the anti-cheating wizards it really needs today.
Hello, this is Cherry Jones, Tony Award-winning actress and narrator of the Little House on the Prairie audiobooks. As an audiobook listener, you know the pleasure of being captivated by a well-told story. You may not know that children who listen to audiobooks enjoy academic benefits as well. Hearing stories read aloud helps children reinforce important fundamental elements of reading readiness and reading comprehension, two key elements of overall success in school. When children listen to recorded stories, they hear and learn new vocabulary, and they practice active listening skills. Children can also listen up. Advanced readers can find challenging and complex stories. Delayed readers can listen and enjoy the story as a whole before breaking it down into smaller pieces. For all children, hearing a good book encourages a lifelong love of literature and reading. So, when you consider what to listen to next, why not also think about the pint-sized listeners in your life and select from one of the many available children's audiobooks?
This recording was produced and directed by Rick Harris. It was edited by Valerie Ratron and Fred Koch. It was mixed and mastered by Richard Romaniello and Lance Neal. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.